Good morning, afternoon, or evening, and welcome to the Bloody Disgusting Network. The passage of time will now bring you to something strange, unique, and idiosyncratic. Have a good time.
There are certain rules that one must abide by in order to successfully survive a horror movie.
Do you want to die, Sydney?
It's your turn to scream, asshole.
From the streets of Woodsboro.
Back to the streets of Woodsboro.
We are Halloweenies!
Happy Halloween, trick-or-treaters, dreamers, campers, and suspects. Welcome back to another episode of Halloweenies, presented by the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network. I'm your host, Michael Myers Rothman, and today we're speaking to a real host with the most. You guessed it, Joe Bob Briggs. A couple weeks ago, my fellow co-host, Mike Vanderbilt, and I hopped on the phone with a genre legend. We jibber-jabbered about, everything under the sun. The state of horror, the way everyone calls everything a masterpiece, the lack of context in any discussion online, you know, the shit that drives us nuts on a day-to-day basis. But really, we wanted to know what Joe Bob thought on Scream and the Scream franchise, and, well, he delivered. He digressed on the seismic impact the film had on the genre, but particularly the slasher genre. He also weighed in on season 3 of Shudder's The Last Drive-In and teased some summer soirees, sorry, twist the tongue, coming up around the bend. And can you believe it? It's already summer. God, my skin can't take it. But look, that's for me to worry about and you to ignore. So sit back, grab a cold one, maybe even a Lone Star, and enjoy the show.
Hey, everybody, have you heard?
Hello?
Hello, Michael?
Yes!
Joe Bob Briggs.
Hey, this is Mike Rothman, and I'm here with my co-host, Mike Vanderbilt.
Hi there, how are you?
Fine, I didn't catch the second name.
It's Mike Vanderbilt.
Mike, oh, two Mike?
Two, yeah. It'll be easy. It'll make it real easy Mike, on you.
Mike and Mike? Okay. Yeah. So which voice is Mike and which voice is Mike?
I'm Mike.
And I'm Mike. Yeah,
I'm on the mic.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Well, first off, I got to kick it off by just, you know, obviously saying congratulations on your Chainsaw Award from last night, which out of all the categories, I felt like that was pretty much the toughest one, really up in the air about what I thought was going to be a winner. Any thoughts on the win? Were you surprised at the win?
Yeah, I was surprised. You know what I was most surprised by? It was actually a good award. You know, usually they give you a plastic statue. You usually get a little plastic statue, you know, that's like worth about $2.99. And this was like a huge, you know, fancy sculpture thing. It was very nice to win. Nonfiction sounds like something in a book contest.
It does,
but
yeah.
But I guess it means I was up against the documentaries. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the award was to the show. It wasn't to me personally. It was to the whole show. So
oh, yeah.
So it was.
So you guys will just round robin the award. It'll go from everybody's mantle for a couple months at a time.
I think, you know what? I think it'll go straight to the set. It's that cool. We'll just leave it on the set. But I'm just happy that Fangoria is still with us, you know? Mm-hmm. Fangoria has had a rough 15 years or so.
Yeah.
I'm just happy that they're thriving and healthy.
It's a hell of a way to kick off your third season, too. I mean, it's kind of perfect timing. It's like the best advertising to align in one weekend.
Terrific films on Friday night's episode. Two of my personal favorites. Mother's Day is one of my all-timers. I love that film.
Really? Are you one of these people that claims to know the plot of House by the Cemetery and what it all means?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It was so great watching you kind of put the needles to Eli Roth and tell me what really happens here, because I felt the same way about Italian cinema.
And by the way, I didn't want to you know, push him too far, but did you notice he never really answered?
I would say.
All right, Eli, what about this part where, you know, she's mopping up the blood on the floor and she comes in and asks about coffee and they just have coffee. And he says, well, coffee is so important. And he just makes a joke. And so I was like, Eli, I want you to defend your movie. But
well, coffee is that important in Italy. You know that. We all know that.
That is true. That is true. If you I don't know how deep into the weeds you want to get on this, but if you read the interviews with people like the screenwriters mm-hmm. who wrote these movies, like Ernesto Gastaldi, for example, is probably the best one of all. They were really trying. And they were really trying to make their movies make sense. And when they don't make sense, you think it's something that the director did to the script. And so when you have like sort of a crazy quilt of illogic, like you have in House by the Cemetery, you wonder what happened. You know, it was written by two of the top screenwriters in Italy. Something happened. You know, something bad happened to that script. Nevertheless, it became a fan favorite for whatever reason, for maybe the special effects. And some people say, well, you know that the guy Freudstein.
Great name. Yeah, right.
But Freudstein down there in the basement, who you finally see in the last 10 minutes of the movie, they say, you know, people say, well, you know, he's such a great character. Really, I don't really see people dressing up like Freudstein. Here's Freddie, here's Michael, and oh, I'm doing Freudstein this year for Halloween.
The deep cuts, only the deepest cuts.
I wonder if it gets so crazy just because he was popping out movies like left and right at that point. You know, I mean, they're in 1 year he has like three films under his name.
All of his best horror was done in about a 2 year period or 3 year period. And then it gets, you know, it starts to decline, starting with New York Ripper. There's a lot mm-hmm. of people who are fans of New York Ripper, but you know, it starts to get, you know, sort of lamer and lamer, but there was this thing going on that, that Eli's aware of and some other people are aware of, but is not talked about that much. And it's this: when you evaluate these films, you have to realize it starts with the giallo, and then the giallo becomes the slasher, and then the slasher takes stuff from the giallo, and then the giallo, and then Italy decides you make money. Italy was always about money. Whatever made the most money, that's right. What they were going to make. And so when the slasher becomes a big deal, they say, fuck giallo. we're going to make slashers. And so they have all these writers who write giallo, but they say, put more slash shit in there. You know? And so after Halloween and Friday the 13th in Italy, they're trying to copy that, but they still have these writers who are trying to craft these suspense thriller type
right.
complicated plots. And so you get this weird kind of hybrid movie, which is very interesting, you know, but anyway, I was trying to put a little bit of a dent into the worship of Italian films.
Because
there are people who say, they were so much better than the American films. Really? Well, yeah. I mean, you can pick one a year that was better, you know?
Definitely. Well,
something I've noticed watching the show, you know, every week when it's on, is that you seem to get the most excited when it's older films, even if it's films that, like, The House by the Cemetery, which you wouldn't necessarily classify as one of your favorites. But is it because you like to get into the history of the filmmaking, or is it just the aesthetics of that era that really do it for you, which makes you love these movies?
Well, absolutely. I do like to get into the history, but the one of the intriguing things to me that we keep going back into is the generational differences in the appreciation of these movies.
Yeah.
when these movies, I mean, Italian movies are a good example. When these came over from when these were exported, they weren't distributed in the United States by Paramount or Universal or 20th Century Fox.
Right.
They were distributed by Joseph Brenner and Roger Corman and Crown International.
Oh, Crown International, one of my favorites.
Yeah, these companies played them off in drive-ins and grindhouses. Well, what did you need in drive-ins and grindhouses? You needed an exciting visual scene every 5 minutes, you know. Mm-hmm. So you needed either nudity or gore for the most part. I mean, those were the two biggies. Later it became action. You know, there was a lot of low-budget action films where you had a lot of car chases and you had a lot of fist fights. But you needed constant, what would be considered lowbrow action. Mm-hmm. And that's why the films thrived. They were not, no one knew they were Italian. You know, if you went to 42nd Street to watch one of these films, it had English names on it. You knew something was wrong with it because the dubbing was so bad.
For years, I thought that's what Franco Nero sounded like from Enter the Ninja. Like, I thought that was his honest-to-God voice.
Yeah, you may have just thought it was, you know, a bad American filmmaker.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, when these things are evaluated by academics and the younger generation of critics, they need to take that into account. Mm-hmm. You know, as Roger Corman always says, film is a compromised art form. It is compromised by business. Therefore, you have to pay attention to the 50% of the creative process that was pure business. And that's especially true with horror films, with the older horror films. Mm-hmm. Even today, it's very interesting to see what a young filmmaker in their 20s who's working in genre, they'll say, "I'm working in genre." they won't say I'm making exploitation movies, but they'll say, "I'm working in genre, but I'm altering the genre conventions."
Right.
And the way they alter the genre convention is the girl keeps her bra on. And so my feeling is, well, see, that's because you don't have to compete in the grindhouse. Mm-hmm. You don't have to compete at the drive-in.
Right.
It's like, if you really had to compete at the grindhouse, that girl would be taking off her bra.
And we're also in, like, such a strange era, too, where, like, I feel like so much context is dismissed, you know? I mean, like, information and pretty much all the classics are readily available at all our fingertips, right? I mean, like, you could log in anywhere, yeah, find any movie and pretty much all the information around it. And yet I just so often feel like the discourse dismisses it. You know, like, we hear, like, every other day, like, oh, this is a masterpiece, or this is the first time it's been done, or, you know, like, finally X, Y, and Z is getting their due. And it's like, well, you know, go back 40 years and this stuff was happening, you know? And it just...
Oh, absolutely.
So weird how that's happening right now. And it's aggravating, to be honest with you. But I mean,
yeah, I mean, there aren't any firsts in movies. All of the firsts yeah, were done by about 1920, you know,
right.
E.W. Griffith did half of them, you know, yeah. and then every time they say, you know, here's a new wave. Well, no, that's an old wave. It's mm-hmm. just dressed up in modern language, you know. Yeah. There are always new things to do, but you can't go outside the conventions of the original cinema. Mm-hmm. You're always going to need to have a great story and a great technician. The story is the screenwriter, and the technician is the director, and to a lesser extent, the editor. And often today, the director and the editor are the same person.
Yeah.
But no matter what someone says they're doing, if the story doesn't deliver on what the story has to deliver on, something satisfying, mm-hmm. it has to deliver on it in a way that's unexpected.
Yeah.
In other words, you have to get to where we think we're going, but in an unexpected way. And when you do that, you win. And that's always been the rules.
That's a good lead-in. Like, so on the podcast, we cover each season, we cover a franchise, a horror franchise. We've done Halloween, we've done Elm Street, we've done Friday the 13th, and this year we're covering the Scream franchise. Now, that came around the 90s, and that was part of what was considered a new wave of horror. We're discussing the films that influenced the series. I was just kind of curious your thoughts on Scream, and what you think are the greatest influences on the series, which ones we should be covering, and if there's maybe any proto-Scream meta, you know, to use a word like genre, meta influences on that series.
To answer the first part of your question, the movie Scream is the conclusion of the slasher era, because after that, there are no surprises in the slasher film. It goes over all the rules you know, to a ridiculous extent, and makes fun of itself. It's the first meta slasher, okay? And so that's the end of the slasher. You can't do a straight ahead slasher anymore. I mean, you can, but you can't really, you know, break new ground in the slasher film. I mean, you could say, well, Hatchet breaks new ground, okay, but it breaks new ground not in the big way that Friday the 13th did or Halloween did or whatever. And the influences on it were the parodies of the slasher. There were lesser parodies prior to Scream, and probably the influence of people like me who were making fun of the slasher. You know? And I wasn't the only one, but you know, the drive-in totals are sort of
right.
Here's what's in a slasher, you know, and so you're building up this audience that knows too much. And so you end up with Scream, which was just done by a master filmmaker saying, okay, we know the jig is up. Here's what happens when the jig is up, you know. And so I think that's where Scream comes from. Scream comes from, you know, self-awareness about what the slasher has become. And then after Scream, you have, you know, increasingly silly, you know, you have Scary Movie. you just take every I mean, as recently as last year, there was a picture that I had a cameo in called Scare Package, which was the whole movie was I don't know if you guys saw it, but it was,
yes, we did, on your show, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, on my show. Okay. It was seven shorts. It was basically an anthology film, but the framing story was, once again, here it was all about the tropes, you know, the slasher tropes, and how nerds at a video store know all the slasher tropes and try to out nerd one another. And so that's the legacy of Scream, you know, and so they're still doing it today. I guess the slasher will always be with us.
Yeah. You know, for better or worse.
Yeah. You read stuff on the internet where people are talking about the final girl, but the people who are talking about the final girl don't know where that comes from. You know, it comes from a very academic book by Carol Clover in the late 80s called Men, Women, and Chainsaws, where she described the final girl. Now, what they don't understand about what she was describing is she was describing a gender switch that happens in the slasher whereby the adolescent male audience becomes female, starts out male and becomes female halfway through the movie. And the final girl is who they live through the final moments of the movie. And so the final girl is treated today as this either a symbol of feminism or a symbol of what's wrong with horror films, you know, that they only have the final girl. They kill off all the other girls so that they'll have one final girl. But what she was describing was there is some cultural myth deep in our subconscious, you know, that's transgender. But the killer is transgender and the final girl is transgender. Everyone is transgender. So it's actually a very, the slasher is very progressive, very progressive movie. It just started in our, it appeals to our subconscious, you know, at a subconscious level. And so we don't recognize it, you know.
Right.
And people who haven't really studied it or looked at it or don't know how movies work, and at what level of our consciousness they work at, take that term, the final girl, and use it to pursue some political thing. But anyway, the Scream started all kinds of stuff, is what I guess I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, even just looking back now, you know, in December 1996, I mean, did you feel that ripple effect when it came out, or did you feel like it was something that you didn't really get its influence until like a few years later? Because I mean, in hindsight, it kind of feels like the Scream, it kind of feels like Scream is almost like the grunge explosion in a way, where it, like, it started out from an earnest place of like, okay, well, we're going to make, you know, we're going to take all our influences, we're going to make something like earnest with it. Mm-hmm. And then it became something that was over corporatized, where like it took horror into another blockbuster level that really kind of was unprecedented in a certain way. And in the same way that grunge became the sort of radio alternative that was a total juxtaposition of what the actual alternative movement of that time was, you know?
Well, you have to remember that the slasher had already petered out. When you're making Silent Night, Deadly Night 5 with Mickey Rooney.
That's true. That's the best one, though. To be fair, that's the best sequel.
It is? Okay. Well, you know, I mean, if you look at, pick a year like 1992 and count the number of sequels above the number three.
Yeah.
You know, it's like three and above, you know, and see what was going on with the slasher era, and you'll see that there were no new ideas coming into that genre, or that subgenre. And so Scream is sort of Wes Craven saying, okay, it's over. Let's define, you know, I was there at the beginning, and by God, I'm going to be there at the end. And so, you know, even the franchises that you can say are beholden to the slasher era, like Hostel or Saw, they go in a new direction. They don't have the same. I mean, you could say maybe Cabin Fever is an original take on the old tropes,
right.
You know. But for the most part, unless you are a guy like Eli Roth who's deliberately copying old movies, you don't have any real advancement of the ideas in the slasher. They've all been put on film.
Yeah.
Sort of like the Western, you know, it's like you get to a point where you've done every Western.
Yeah,
and every once in a while you have something come along like Silverado or Tombstone, you know, but it's a one-off, you know. The golden age when there were 50 Westerns a year, 100 Westerns a year, that's gone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you could say the same for what Scream did to the slasher. You know, we're not going to have another year where we have 30 slashers come out.
The good old days. What's a subgenre that you think is ripe for horror filmmakers right now? You know, with the slasher all but dead, like, is there anything that you think we should see more of, or you think we will be seeing more of?
Despite the fact that we have more interest in horror than we've ever had in history,
right?
We're kind of in a decadent period because horror finally won the Academy Award, Shape of Water. Okay. But it was a rubber suit creature movie. it was an homage to rubber suit creatures, and so it was acceptable because all the people who originally hated Creature from the Black Lagoon are dead, and so now it's a beloved subgenre from 1952 or whatever, you know. It's like, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, you can finally do that one, you know. The Academy will vote for you if you do that one, you know. But as far as new things, I think, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but Eli Roth was a little bit hesitant to talk very much about Hostel. But I think Hostel created a new type of subgenre, and what he put in there was kind of politics. He put politics in there, and then we had Get Out, and there was more politics in there. And so if there's any direction that we're moving, it's sort of that's the direction. But that's a dangerous direction, because if you put the politics too close to the surface, then people hate it.
Yeah.
And so you got to be really, really good.
It's like you said in that article about text versus subtext.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's Jordan Peele did it really well. And then the remake of Black Christmas, they did it really badly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so you have to really be a skillful filmmaker to go in that direction. What I'm waiting for is, you know, horror has always been a place where you explore the guilty secrets of our subconscious that you can't really deal on a real level. And so you put it in a horror film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been true since, you know, Frankenstein, Dracula, everything from the beginning. And so what I'm waiting for is the filmmaker who does that in a very visceral way that goes against the culture, you know, that mm-hmm. goes against the conventional wisdom.
Right.
And I can't really name the guy who would be doing that right now. There are a lot of guys at the, you know, ultra low budget level who try weird stuff. I hope they're not being cut off from larger budgets by, you know, the five big companies that control streaming, because, you know, that's sort of, you know, we're moving into this world where nobody has any physical media. And so they can cut you off at the knees yep. by just right. like not making you available for streaming. That's really my greatest fear, is that the truly rebellious subgenres or politically incorrect subgenres get censored by, simply not because anybody says, oh, I hate this, I despise it, you know, but because it's controversial.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the corporate guy, you go, you know what, we would just have an easier life if that movie didn't exist. And yes. so, okay, take that off the list. And it just goes, you know, yes. just overnight. It's just gone.
Sounds familiar. Sounds like the MPAA in the 80s. Sounds like Tipper Gore in the yeah. 80s. Like, we've seen this all before, right? But it doesn't mean it's not
yeah.
there.
But it's a little bit different now, because Tipper Gore really believed, she was really a moralist. She was a moralizer.
Right.
And to a certain extent, Jack Valenti was a moralizer. He was mm-hmm. trying to protect Hollywood from all these evil things that were going on in society. You know, now we're talking about just accounting.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's just guys with green eye shades, you know, in a in a tall black building in North Hollywood somewhere, who are saying, you know what, we're looking at the social media numbers on the people mm-hmm. who say this movie has got this, too much of this in it. You know, I think we should just cut that off, because it's affecting our sales over here on the other side. And so the movie just doesn't find a home. It just doesn't find a place to live where it's widely accessible.
Right.
You know?
No, it's definitely a fear.
I mean, you can still go to the TerrorCon in Lawrence, Kansas, and sell individual DVDs at your table. You know, yeah. So, but you just won't have a streaming contract.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
where all the action is these days. It's the new video store.
Well, and that's this false illusion that I mean, you're right. I mean, I don't think anyone's really contending with that yet, just because there's so much out there, you know, like everyone's like, oh, there's so much content. But at some point it is going to be filtered down. And I mean, it already is happening. I mean, we're just not, I mean, just because it launches another streaming network next week, or, you know, next month brings another one. Like, if you look closely, they are all, you know, being owned by the bigger corporations at this point, where it's literally just going to become cable network again, with just with even more of a shorter, you know, funneling stream, which
yeah.
is scary for sure.
You know, one thing I'm doing a film festival this summer. We'll see if I do a second year of it. We'll see how it goes. But it's called Mutant Fest, and
yeah.
and it's devoted to the ultra low budget filmmaker who has to work outside the financial systems of New York, LA, London.
That's at the Great Mahang Drive-In, right?
That's at the Mahoning Drive-In, yeah, in Lahighton, Pennsylvania. Translation, middle of fucking nowhere. It's like not many people know that the Appalachians go all the way up into Pennsylvania, but this is the Appalachian part of Pennsylvania. And so, you know, it's in this valley between a bunch of mountains. And the idea is these guys have no place. You know, I talked to these guys. They've spent 5 years working on their passion project, and they finally get it finished, and they say, okay, what are you going to do with it? Well, right now it's on Amazon, you know. I say, yeah. You gave it to fucking Amazon? Yeah. You know, it's like, what do you get a nickel every time 9,000 people watch it? Yeah. You know, it's like, why did you do that? Why did you do that? You know, get it back, take it back. You know? and so part of the purpose of this festival is to start developing networks whereby politically incorrect films or films that don't have the production values of the major films, we can figure out distribution systems that bypass. We're essentially going to try to create a digital grindhouse world.
I love it.
So that in the future, there will be a place for the outlaw rebel filmmaker.
I love that. I love
yeah.
that.
Of course. I mean, Mike, you're running your own drive-in too.
I am running a drive-in in a bar parking lot right now. That is 100% true.
Yeah. Where's the drive-in?
It's in a suburb of Chicago called Blue Island, Illinois.
Okay.
We put up a screen to, because I had worked with them. You've done work with the Music Box Theater. I did work with them on there. I was part of the programming team for the Music Box of Horrors drive-in. And then we built one in the bar parking lot where I tend bar at. And we show movies every weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Oh, great.
And it was to survive during COVID because we couldn't have people in the bar, but we could have people order drinks in the bar and go drink in their car, which, of course, is 100% safe.
Yeah. Yeah. Get them tanked up right before
it. Tanked up right, and
right before the last reel. Yeah. So, yeah. As a matter of fact, Sven Gulli and I are going to do a show at the Music Box as soon as it's safe for old farts to come out.
Oh,
and
awesome.
So,
I can't wait for that.
Yeah, I did. The Music Box did that show. They did a drive-in show, and I did a video intro for it. I hate video intros. I hate them. I hate talking to my phone.
Thank you for doing that, Chris. I know exactly which movie it was because it's one of my personal favorites. It was Jackie Kong's The Being.
The Being, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The Being, right. Yeah, so I did the drive-in totals on it for the Music Box temporary drive-in when I hope they're open again.
We're doing
another back doing and a, they're doing yeah, another run.
We're I doing think. Another drive-in weekend at the end of the month with Halloween 3, a favorite of yours. I know.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Okay. Why are you doing that? You're going to pair it with House by the Cemetery and make it really painful?
Can you please do an intro for that one if we do that?
No.
But then we're doing Midsommar and Alucarda.
Uh-huh.
And then Friday the 13th, Part 3 and Sleepaway Camp.
Oh, okay. Sleepaway Camp. I love Sleepaway Camp.
Same here.
Talk about a movie that was ahead of its time.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah. You know, nobody talks about the fact that we got all the guys. There's no female nudity in the film. But there's all these, you know, tight butts and skinny dipping on the part of the male counselors, you know.
Well, yeah. And something I always bring up about Angela is everybody who she kills absolutely deserves it.
Oh,
everybody gets what they deserve in that movie.
Yep, that's absolutely true. Yeah. Yeah. Felissa Rose.
Mangled dick expert.
she's our official mangled dick expert at the last drive-in. Yes, she is.
Well, speaking of guests, you know, you mentioned Eli Roth a bunch and just killed it in this season premiere. Were you surprised at how deep he went into his knowledge, or did you have an idea of how?
Oh no, I was not surprised. I mean, Eli goes on tangent after tangent after tangent, but you let him go because yeah. every tangent, no matter how unrelated to the original question, has a value in itself. So no, I was very prepared to let him talk. I just tried to guide him towards the things I really wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite part of the show, I wasn't talking at all. It's when he explained that thing about why they don't do sync sound in Italy. You know, it's going back to the time of Mussolini when you're not allowed to record sound on the set of a movie, and then how that got translated into the way they make movies today. I mean, he is as nerdy about this stuff as I am. And I think the reason both of us are this nerdy is because up until very recently, there was not a whole lot of information on these films that we love. And so you had to be a sort of, you know, library rat and a detective in order to find out a lot of this stuff. I mean, we had, back when I was at TNT, we would sometimes show movies. All we had was the name of the director. We didn't know who he was or where he was from or where he was now. You know, it would be some guy from Iran or something. We didn't know if he was back in Iran or if we could find him in L.A. or what. And so we relied a lot on just phone calls, you know. Somebody worked on the crew. Who is this guy? Where did this movie come from? Where was it filmed? Because sometimes they wouldn't tell you where it was filmed, you know? And so we've come a long way. Now we're in the world of too much information too much wrong information, you know? If there's this thing of the plausible falsehood. So something about a movie that sounds sort of plausible, but is totally untrue gets on the web and gets repeated 1,000 times because it's a cool fact.
Yep.
You know, and so by being repeated 1,000 times, it becomes true.
Oh yeah. Well, and that's kind of the same way with discourse too. I mean, like, everything's a masterpiece, right? Like, every week you hear about another movie that you might have thought was like, that was pretty good. No, it's a masterpiece. And everyone's going to say it, and then everyone retweets it. Then it becomes part of this like cultural lexicon where it's like, well, actually the discourse has changed around that. You know, like when we mentioned Halloween 3, and that used to be like a kind of fringe movie. You're like, it's a sequel that doesn't have Michael Myers. Now it's like, oh, it's a masterpiece. It's one of the best. It's the, you know, I mean, I like the movie, but at the same time, like the point, like there's so many of those now, like every film that you maybe even film on 2005 that you're like, that was forgettable. Now it's a masterpiece. Somebody wrote an op-ed.
I can't tell you how many interviews I've done or interviews I've read or interviews I've watched where they say, you know, it's Quentin Tarantino's favorite movie. You think they're bullshitting you, and then you find some reference somewhere where Quentin Tarantino actually said it was his favorite movie. But he's said at least 400 different movies are his favorite movie.
Yeah, for the record, his favorite Friday the 13th movie is Part 5, is the rumor that I heard.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, no joke.
New Beginning. Oh my lord. Yeah,
That's a shocking one.
Yeah. I think we're running out of time, but we have one question. It actually has the links with Friday the 13th. Mike, you had a question that was set up on. I'm setting you up. I'm teeing you up for this one.
So on our show last season, when we discussed the Friday the 13th films, we would compare each one to Martin Scorsese's The Irishman and decide which movie accomplishes its goals better.
Almost all of them, right?
Yeah, right. I think you just answered our question. Do you think any of the Friday the 13th films are better than The Irishman?
Yes, I was not a fan of The Irishman. So yeah, but I mean, I to tell you the truth, I get the Friday the 13th and Halloween numbers mixed up because I watched them when they came out.
Right.
You know? And so you don't remember from one year to the next exactly who was in which one. But I seem to remember Friday the 13th 4 being the best one.
That's the, I always call that one the quintessential Friday the 13th movie.
Yeah. And then they set up 4, correct me if I'm wrong, but they set up 4 for kind of a whole new way to go in 5. But they never went that way.
Right. Exactly. Right. That,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You remember, kind of you got it.
Yeah. Yeah. How about that? You know, star of a Martin Scorsese film. has proven that the Friday the 13th is better than. I think that's the official closing of the bit.
Don't get me wrong. I'm a big Martin Scorsese fan. I've actually had the opportunity to talk exploitation movies with Scorsese.
Oh wow.
The first question he asked me is, "What's the best women in prison?" And I said, I didn't know what the correct answer was, so I said, Chained Heat, And he says, I think you might be right.
I'm willing to agree with that, too. I think Chained Heat goes amongst the top of the women in prison flicks.
But then his next question was, would you agree that the women in prison movie is a genre of its own and not a subgenre of the prison movie? And I said, you are absolutely right, Mr. Scorsese. What am I going to say? Marty, no. You're wrong.
Come on now. I am a big fan of Boxcar Bertha, too. Boxcar Bertha still sits as one of my top 10 Scorsese films.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I
agree with you. I asked him what he thought of The Honeymoon Killers, because he was hired to direct The Honeymoon Killers and fired after 1 week. And so I said, how do you think The Honeymoon Killers came out? And he said, I've never been able to watch it.
Oh, wow.
I said, really? And he said, I didn't work for 3 years. I said, well, I hope they realized their mistake later. And he says, no, they were absolutely right to fire me. And I said, why? And he said, because I was shooting long tracking shots with no coverage, just like I do today. And he says, they looked at it and they said, there's no coverage. Kept asking me for coverage, and I was not giving them enough coverage. And they were absolutely right to fire me. And so I said, wow. He says, but then when I made Boxcar Bertha, I storyboarded everything, living in fear of the day Roger Corman would come to the set. And he finally did come to the set. We were in Arkansas. He finally did come to the set, and he stayed about 2 hours, and he looked at the storyboards, and he says, very good, very good. That's fine. And he left. He said that I was so relieved.
Vindicated.
We need a new Roger Corman now more than ever.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. You know, Roger has three... Roger is 95, just turned 95, and has three movies in active development.
This doesn't stop. God.
But you're right that the role of the aggressive exploitation producer, it seems, where did all those guys go? Where did they go? I don't know because I
say to myself, like, why can't we just have somebody say, all right, I'll make this script for you. I'll give you this much money, but you have to shoot it in 5 days, and it'll have killer poster art, and that'll be it.
And I want three naked girls in it, and I want and I want one car chase.
Yeah.
You know, he would say, I mean, the drive-in totals come from my conversations with Roger Corman. And Roger Corman used to say, as far as above-the-waist female nudity goes, you need three girls. The lead... And then two other girls. The lead should be naked from the waist up in two scenes, one near the beginning of the film and one after the halfway point. The other two girls should be naked one time each. If you have these four scenes, the viewer will think that he has seen a lot more than he has actually seen.
He's so savvy and like has it down to his science. I love it. Well, I am an advocate for more nudity in horror movies. Bring it back.
Yeah.
And I mean, Darcy's always on my case saying, you know, you should have just as much male nudity. That's fine with me.
Absolutely fine with me. Yeah. I mean, I feel like we're still in that runoff of like the puritanical early aughts.
Oh my God.
It's just like, we're like, it's scandalous. Well,
yeah.
It's
not really from scandalous. 1620 till now. Yeah. The puritanical.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Touche.
Like, keep looking like it's going to get better, and then it just gets worse.
It just keeps pivoting away. We go back to our roots, which is great. God bless America. Well, Jovo, thank you so much for talking to us. This has been just
all right. Thank you, guys.
I can't wait to watch the rest of the season.
It truly was a pleasure.
Okay. See you soon. All right. Bye.
Let's go.
Well, that wraps up today. As you already know, Joe Bob is keeping us entertained every Friday night on Shudder with The Last Drive-In. Most of us Halloweenies live tweet during all those movies, so be sure to follow us for all added fun. Sensational fun. I think that's what Milo says on the cover of the VHS version of The Mask. Anyway, as for what's next, good question. As I said before, we're on the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, which is incredibly exciting for us because we're with lots of our pals, Trace and Joe of the Horror Queers, Megan Navarro, who was just on her 28 Days Later podcast episode on the rental. She does her own podcast, Bloody Disgusting Podcast. So you'll definitely be seeing a lot of crossover episodes down the road. But coming up very soon is our deep dive on Scream 2, which is incredibly exciting because it's been since February that we've been walking around Woodsboro. But we're not going to be at Woodsboro this time. No, 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 no. We are going to be at Windsor College, where I'm going to be talking about Timothy Olyphant. I think I said the right name right. I always say Olyphant. Timothy Elephant. No, Timothy Olyphant. I'm really excited because it's a personal favorite of mine. I think it's the best of the franchise, but we'll debate that on our long, lengthy episode. But that's not all. Over on our Patreon, www.patreon.com/Halloweenies pod, we're going to be delivering a commentary track for A Nightmare on Elm Street for Mother's Day. How sweet, huh? It seemed fitting. And then we'll also be doing a rental deep dive on The Descent. Getting claustrophobia already. but for now, don't forget to return your videotapes. Be sure to be kind and rewind. And rest assured, we'll be right back.
This is the end of our show, for now. Tune in next week. If you like our programming, consider searching for other Bloody Disgusting podcasts, such as Creepy, Horror Queers, The Boo Crew, SCP Archives, Nightlight, Margaret's Garden, Nightmare on Film Street, and more.